The maternity ward in Paris was quiet when Marlowe arrived, but inside Thomas Chatterton Williams' chest, a storm was brewing. His newborn daughter's blue eyes, eyes he knew would stay blue, stared back at him with an innocence that felt almost accusatory. "What have you done?" a voice whispered from somewhere deep inside. For a man raised on the American gospel of the one-drop rule, that any trace of black ancestry makes you black, this blonde, pale child in his arms rendered everything he believed suddenly absurd. How could he call himself black when his daughter, carrying his genes, would never be seen that way? This wasn't just new parent anxiety. It was the beginning of an intellectual earthquake that would crack open every certainty he'd built his identity upon. In a country still wrestling with racial division, where both left and right cling to rigid categories, Williams offers something rare, a willingness to question the very foundation of how we see each other. Williams grew up between worlds. His father, a freckled, red-brown man whose grandfather was born enslaved, had escaped poverty through intellect, filling their middle-class New Jersey home with books and ideas. His mother, light-skinned with Northern European features, possessed what his father called black consciousness. They deliberately lived on the white side of their segregated town, a quiet protest against redlining. Outside, the world saw something else. A white woman at the grocery store assumed his mother had adopted those kids from the ghetto. Throughout the 80s and 90s, their family drew confused stares. The word biracial didn't enter Williams' vocabulary until college in 1999. One afternoon, when Williams casually dismissed boxing's importance, his father made a sharp three-point turn. "Who told you not to like boxing? I'll be damned if they make you white." The words revealed something startling. Identity could be imposed rather than inherited. When offered a choice between an elite white prep school and a diverse school nearby, Williams chose the latter, his first meaningful assertion of racial identity. What does it mean to perform an identity? Throughout high school, Williams threw himself into blackness with convert-like fervor. Without extended black family to guide him, he absorbed black masculinity from basketball courts and BET. His father's genes gave him physical features, but didn't prescribe how to walk, talk, or carry himself. Blackness became the angle of your hat brim, the rhythm in your walk, the studied nonchalance in your voice. Yet this identity was often defined through distorted lenses. Williams and his peers conflated race with class, manners, and taste. His brother's Italian friend called their bookish father whiter than his own uneducated dad. At 15, Williams fell for Stacy, who embodied everything he thought blackness should be. Many black boys he knew preferred white or Spanish girls, a colonial mentality that turned his stomach. At Georgetown, he displayed Stacy's photos like badges of authenticity. When he returned from freshman year, everything collapsed. Stacy mocked his evolving tastes. "Them white niggas got you buggin'," became pregnant by a drug dealer, and moved to the projects. Heartbroken, Williams clung to his conviction. He was inherently a black man who could only be complete with a black woman. Living in France revealed something startling. Race isn't fixed, but changes depending on where you're standing. In kebab shops, Algerian workers addressed Williams in Arabic, confused when he couldn't respond. When he explained he was black American, one man protested, "But you are not black. Michael Jordan is black." The categories he'd spent his life accepting simply didn't translate. White Americans made similar mistakes. A tourist cracked racist jokes in Williams' presence, later apologizing by saying he'd assumed Williams was Mediterranean. This failure to be recognized as he would be at home attracted many black American expats to France. Race became something imposed rather than intrinsic, an afterimage, as one scholar put it, conditioned not just by who we are, but by where we are. In 2008, at 26, Williams received a life-changing book advance and borrowed a friend's Paris studio. The city offered liberation from American racial categorization. His expanding sense of self coincided with Obama's campaign, which initially filled him with unprecedented idealism. But while canvassing in Baltimore's impoverished neighborhoods, Williams realized that despite his African ancestry, he shared little with the residents. The distance between them had nothing to do with melanin and everything to do with opportunity. Williams met Valentine in a Paris bar when he was 28. She arrived with a mutual friend, yellow curls flowing over an old fur coat, triggering something powerful in him. They bonded over shared values, a need to travel, belief in words, willingness to sacrifice comfort to earn their living through writing. The morning after his spontaneous rooftop proposal brought exhilaration and terror. Choosing a white woman felt anything but trivial. He thought of Eldridge Cleaver condemning James Baldwin for the racial death wish that motivates blacks to partner with whites. Was he exhibiting the same self-hatred? His parents' reactions surprised him. His mother's tears revealed her intuition that this union would place an ocean between them, not because of race, but because two freelance writers would naturally gravitate to France's more affordable living. His father's unqualified happiness revealed a blues-like stoicism that could hold conflicting ideas simultaneously. Race isn't real, yet race had harmed him severely. 8 years into marriage, William still occasionally hears Cleaver's question. Why do successful black men so disproportionately marry outside their race? This reality hit home when he met Ishmael Reed in Paris. Williams hesitated bringing Valentine, irrationally worried about disappointing this pro-black literary figure. Yet Reed's wife was white, as were the wives of the saxophonist host and another black expat writer. The pattern was impossible to ignore. Since marrying Valentine and moving to France, Williams struggles to speak at universities about his first book. At historically black colleges, the hip-hop culture he critiques is simply the air students breathe. More significantly, his black experience has veered drastically from theirs. During one Florida session, a dark-skinned student with meticulously twisted dreadlocks asked why white people hate us so much. Williams realized this young man had probably never intimately known or loved a white person, or been known or loved by one. He explained that while racists exist, most white people don't actively hate black people. They simply don't think seriously about them at all. Since 2016, Williams has watched well-meaning white friends publicly flagellate themselves for their whiteness, as if born into original sin. Today's dominant liberal discourse, positioning whites as the nation's only genuine actors and minorities as hapless props, proves counterproductive. When race becomes an irreducible political category rather than incorporated into universal claims of justice, it becomes a weapon anyone can use. To shift this paradigm, we need new vocabulary beyond abstract racial categorization. Contemporary commentators on race, by establishing identities solely in the body, reinforce the same racist habits they claim to defeat. Progress requires sloughing off these old skins we've been forced to don. In Provence, after Saul's birth, William's rented house welcomed people of all backgrounds. What felt exceptional was how normal it seemed. He may never stop noticing differences, but he ceased allowing them to determine interactions. Pacing the terrace with Saul, Williams read Camus. Poverty kept me from thinking all was well under the sun and in history, but the sun taught me that history was not everything. History explains inherited inequalities, but its utility diminishes when it smothers the present's possibilities. Over dinner in Berlin, Williams showed Adrian Piper a photo of 3-year-old Marlo Ivory with blue eyes and golden curls, admitting he worried she might not feel the guilt that shaped his identity. "Why would you want that?" Piper asked. "If the pain isn't there, why introduce it?" Williams left that dinner an ex-black man, not because he'd stopped loving what he'd been taught to call black, but because these categories cannot capture anyone. We're like chickens hypnotized by lines in dirt, immobilized by marks existing only because we believe in them. The line remains visible, but it has no power except what we give it.